Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Social media is to elites like body cams are for the cops, right? It's like suddenly stuff that you wouldn't have seen is there on display, often out of context and manipulable in various ways, right? Like you think you're getting the truth because it's video, but video too can be manipulated and decontextualized in many ways, as we've seen.
I've wanted to interview Antonio Garcia Martinez for so long. I actually read his book, Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley years ago, and it's literally one of my favorite books of all time. I have it on Audible, and I loved it so much I purchased it in paperback as well, too, to have on my bookshelf that you can notice on YouTube if you watch the show there. It's been a real privilege to speak with him just because there's obviously a lot of controversy around Antonio. If you want to get into the circumstances of his firing from Apple and all the dynamics there, you could go check out a different episode because, frankly, I think the most interesting thing about him isn't a debate about cancellation. It's just the fact that this is a guy who can go and have a podcast conversation on everything from the 30 Years' War and the founding of the nation state in 1648 to debates about Latinx, to Israel-Palestine, to advertising, to whether Miami can tell us something about America's tribal future. There's so much here of it. I just really loved getting into it with him. So I can't recommend this episode enough. It's a really great conversation. It's going to go a bunch of different places, but I think sometimes it's good for us to embrace the lack of a script and outline and just roll with it. So a lot of great stuff. A couple big notes that I want to hit before we dive into the episode. Huge re-up on the Realignment Conference. We are nearing capacity. Huge thank you to everyone who's sent in applications so far, but I'd love to get more from everyone out. There's so much to do. We're really excited to see everyone in Miami on October 22nd. So definitely go into the show notes and take a look at the link there. Secondly, everyone here knows that this podcast is sponsored by the Lincoln Network, not Lincoln Project. Lincoln Network focuses on tech and policy and debates between Washington, D.C. and Silicon Valley. And frankly, the perfect fit for an episode of Antonio Garcia Martinez is a quick announcement about Lincoln Network's Policy Hackers program. Policy Hackers is a year-long non-resident fellowship program for tech professionals, aka people who also aren't working in policy in Washington. It's really interesting. There's a great curriculum designed to help people with busy schedules learn more about innovation, learn about the policy process, learn how think tanks, trade associations, lobbying shops, different legislative procedures, how to work with state and federal agencies, so many different things. If I'm going to really sum up a program which is going to equip people who are in our audience who are trying to learn more about how their knowledge in the private sector, in the public sector, basically anywhere outside of Washington, D.C. can be applied to all of the different problems we're talking about today, I cannot recommend this program enough. So if you are interested at all, if you work in technology policy or interested in breaking in, definitely go to the link in the show notes below to go check out what we're looking at. Thirdly, of course, huge shout out to the Substack. We love getting additional subscribers, and we're going to have an issue coming out later today. So definitely go and subscribe to the Realignment Substack. It is also included in the show notes as well. Finally, huge thing. We love how everyone got us past 2,000 ratings on Apple Podcasts. So we obviously don't really need to do an aggressive push. So instead, we're going to just keep on answering people's questions on the show. So let's get to the Q&A period before we get into the episode. Today's question is a perfect fit for everything I'm talking with Antonio about. Quick reminder, you can email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com or leave us a 5-star review with your question. Today's question is from WhatsUp987. Regarding moderation, why is it so much to ask that social media sites not moderate, but instead provide extensive tools for users to control and curate their own experiences? I feel like everyone, including Alex Kantrovich, skips that as an option. Great question. So here's the problem. The reason why that is skipped over is that doesn't exactly get at the core of the actual problem. So for example, think about it this way. Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, all these services are free. They're free because they are based off of advertising. So the primary customer that drives all of the boatloads of money that all these services build off of isn't the user per se. The customer is the actual advertiser. So if you're an advertiser, do you want your advertisement showing up random places? Do you want there to be a screenshot of someone putting up a video that's maybe white supremacist, racist, anti-LGBTQ, pick basically anything possibly offensive? If you're tied, do you want that showing up before that video? No, you don't. Therefore, if your business is built on advertising, people having the option of curating an individual experience where they say, look, I don't care if white supremacist content shows up in front of me, isn't particularly useful for the company or the actual advertisers. So therefore, it's not just that moderation actually helps in its best form curate an experience that's actually enjoyable. It actually enables the business to actually work. Because if you're looking at YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, none of these businesses would be able to get advertisers if advertisers couldn't have some degree of certainty that their content wouldn't, that their advertising wouldn't go in front of content. It'd be really damaging for their reputations. That would put them in front of the wrong users, all those different parts. The only world where I could see it making sense to allow users to hyper-design their own experiences in a way that would negate moderation in the advertising dilemma is if these platforms had some sort of subscription option. So maybe you pay for subscription Instagram or subscription Twitter or subscription Facebook. And because you're the primary customer in that type of situation, Facebook would have no problem designing a specific experience or allowing you to design a specific experience for yourself. But on a broader level, you should just understand that maybe that could be a good option. And there definitely should be a lot of options for people curating their feeds. But that doesn't actually get to the underlying reasons why brands, companies, and frankly, other users who aren't just yourselves demand for moderation. But still a good question that brings up a lot of the structural factors here. Wow, that is so much. So this is the perfect time just to dive into the episode. Hope you guys enjoy. Antonio Garcia Martinez, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me on.
I think I paid you the highest compliment a podcaster prepping for a show could pay when I was reading a bunch of your Substacks at the pull request, and I subscribed this afternoon because I read six of them. I really enjoyed it. Yeah, so I think that's a good place for us to start, everyone. We recommend books a lot. Obviously, you all need to read Chaos Monkeys, but I think the more pressing thing for everyone to do, because Antonio is newly employed as a Substack writer, so people to go check out Pull Request and subscribe as well, too.
And that's at thepullrequest.com. Not that I love articles, but pullrequest.com is actually a Y Combinator startup that has nothing to do with my blog. And I'm sure it's a great product, but it has absolutely nothing to do with my writing.
We just pulled a drop the from Facebook sign.
Exactly. Like, I'm glad somebody got the reference. Exactly. I'm glad someone got the reference. Exactly. Exactly.
No, so this is great because what I really appreciate around your writing ever since I read Chaos Monkeys is that you have a really useful way of thinking around the world or thinking about the world and thinking about the different problems and history. So I think the best thing to do for our episode, because I think our audience is going to get a kick out of a lot of your ideas, is just kind of move around your different thoughts, different things you've really talked about. And the place where I've wanted to start for a while, ever since I actually read you in Wired a few years ago, is this idea that America's conflicts today can be explained by this idea that we're in a 30 years war, Protestants versus Catholics, religious war situation. A, for people who did not pay attention during AP Euro, can you explain the 30 years war, Gutenberg, printing press? Just give everyone the full rundown.
I mean, I have to come at these tech issues from a slightly more kind of historical point of view, more so than the average techie, I think. I mean, I think technology sort of characterizes itself by taking the ahistorical view, which is one of the many necessary delusions I think that technologists need these days. But I somehow can't remove, you know, the son of the librarian who read widely as a child kind of viewpoint from it. And so getting to your, you know, admittedly potentially a little bit recondite reference that I made to the 30 Years' War. So the thing here is in the late 15th century, right, this guy Gutenberg, who was actually forgotten by history for a long time and then kind of rediscovered later by German nationalists, invented this thing called, movable type. And in fact, it wasn't really the printing press, as it's commonly called. And it wasn't even one invention, it was actually several. He had to invent the paper, the inks, everything, actually. He really was a genius in many ways. And what that created was this flurry of sort of uncensored, unmoderated, I guess, is the current au courant word for censorship, basically. And it created this flurry of sort of heterodox thinking and revolt against the established order of things, including Martin Luther, who, posted his famous theses, which these days would actually be a BuzzFeed listicle called, 91 Reasons Why the Catholic Church Sucks or whatever, right? And it would go viral on Facebook and it would instantly be charged as being misinformation by the Catholic priests and, whatever. And he would be deplatformed or whatever. There'd be calls for his deplatforming. And so I'm making these what seem like absurd parallels because it really was that. There was these things called Flugschriften, literally flying writings. They're basically pamphlets whose design even looks like a Facebook post. It's like this garish photo of, the Pope doing something ridiculous, like, something insulting, often really obscene, things that would not have passed the Facebook content policy today, let's put it that way, if you posted photos of the Pope doing that, along with some obviously hyperbolic, if not outright false, piece of, anti-papal or pro-papal or whatever propaganda, right? And, and that was more or less the story of the printing press for a lot of it. Although it took a while for matters to reach ahead, right? The printing press was invented in the late 15th century. Luther was in sort of the early middle 16th century, and then things really exploded at the beginning of the 17th century in 1618, if my history is correct, that the 30 Years' War started. And for those, in the United States, good red-blooded Americans understand that history really started in 1776 and everything before was a mistake, to be clear. But in fact, we should just rewrite the calendar to like start zero at 1776. So this is actually negative, whatever, 130. But going back in the before times, the 30 Years' War was this horribly bloody, terrible conflict that tore apart Europe and basically split it into Catholic and Protestant sides. And there's a lot of outcomes from it. Millions of people died, famines, new religious orders were started. It was this moment of just intellectual and religious and political foment. And I often ask the sort of rhetorical question is that, like, if you had asked your average European peasant in 1618, right, or 1645 at the sort of height of the 30 Years' War, if the printing press was a good idea, they would, a lot of people would have said, well, not so clear, or probably not at all. Certainly, if you had asked a Catholic or a Catholic clergy in the 17th century, was the printing press a good idea? And they said, no, it's a terrible idea. In the same way that New York Times writers think that, Substack is a terrible idea. And that's what it is, right? And it's in some sense, I think it was Balaji Srinivasan who posted something recently that I retweeted saying that, like, we're evolving technologically a lot faster than we are culturally, right? And I mean, that was true in the 17th century, and it's true even now, right? And I think the way I look at, people often ask, like, so Antonio, what do you think? You whine about the moderation thing, you whine about the misinformation industrial complex. Like, what is the answer here? And it's a good question to ask. And I think the answer often is, like, I don't know if there is a solution. Like, I think it's technologists or people who've worked in technology who are often more likely to say, in fact, there is no technological solution. Like, I don't think there's a change to the algorithm you can make that suddenly makes it that Twitter is like peace and love and happiness and people like amiably and agreeably talking about ideas. Like, there's no code push you could make that changes that. Right. However, I think there are cultural code changes that we can make, right? Because let's face it, people aren't publishing pamphlets now that are overthrowing the US government, right, in a way that was happening in the 17th century in its analogous way. So I'll stop there. But that's what I meant by that idea.
Yeah. And I think what is so interesting about the idea and really ties it today is this thought that the printing press exposed hierarchies and establishments and underlying fights or potential fights that weren't out in the open. So obviously Europe wasn't just chill in the 1400s. It just seemed that way. But what the technology did was reveal the underlying nations, religious disagreements, literacy fights, all those parts. And social media today can have that effect. But what I'm wondering here is, do you think that social media, and by social media, I just mean Twitter, Facebook, that type of interaction, do you think it creates discord or do you think it reveals discord?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, right? Like, it's social media is to elites like body cams are for the cops, right? It's like suddenly stuff that you wouldn't have seen is there on display, often out of context and manipulable in various ways, right? Like you think you're getting the truth because it's video, but video too can be manipulated and decontextualized in many ways, as we've seen. That's a great question. I think that's one of the big questions I ask myself, right? Like, look, the news has always been kind of fake, right? If you actually go back and read, for example, the coverage of World War II, for example, just stick a random period at the time, and then go read historians with a lot more sort of depth, and not necessarily even the most revisionist historians, just those who have a fuller picture. A lot of the reporting on World War II was kind of a lie, right? It might have been a necessary lie, given in fact there was a war effort going on.
What's an example of that?
There was active military censorship. You couldn't show pictures of dead GIs, right? You couldn't, you know, if a battle had gone poorly, the Battle of the Bulge, which was kind of the German army, the Wehrmacht's last hurrah. I don't have a link off the top of my head, but I'm guessing the coverage at the time was not portraying it as the route that it kind of was, at least very briefly, right? To cite a more proximal example, just because I'm getting neck deep into Israel because I'm traveling there soon, during the Yom Kippur War, in the first couple of days, the war went terribly, and the government actually censored the actual casualty figures because it was considered so demoralizing. No one wanted to hear about the thousands dead in the Golan Heights when the Syrian tanks were still rolling into Israel, right? And so again, it was potentially a necessary lie, but it was nonetheless a lie, right? But then getting back to your question, it's like, okay, but like, do things really suck? Is the news more fake now than it used to be? Or is it just the fact that someone can actually sit there and throw the tomato before they could? I don't know. It's a good question. Do our elites actually suck as much as they seem? Or have they always sucked and now you're just seeing them suck? I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah, because the part that's just interesting to me, and I'm not just bringing him up as a dunk, because there's a part of tech Twitter that loves dunking on Scott Galloway, but I am treating him more as a really eloquent reciter of a certain type of conventional wisdom within center left circles. So I hate Mark Zuckerberg because Mark Zuckerberg creates this platform which weaponizes our democracy and spreads disinformation and basically causes all these different social conflagrations. But from my perspective, all it seems to me, separate from Russiagate stuff, it seems to me what social media is doing is basically preventing. It's just the nichification of everything, right? It just prevents there being one or two or even three grand narratives that people are then forced into. And then the more you break those narratives up, the more niche you get, the less focused in you get, the harder it is to have a coherent story. And the lack of a coherent story leads to chaos. So I think that's what I think it would be.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, fragmentation is definitely part of the story. I mean, if you look at the rise of modern electronic media, by which I mean TV, radio, I mean the whole shebang before the internet from like roughly the 30s until whatever, the early aughts or the late 90s for early adopters, right? Information moved at the speed of light, but it was very throttled and controlled. And if you go back and read people like Marshall McLuhan or the early media theorists or Postman or whatever, I'm using ourselves to death, right? They were very fixated on the impact of what this visual media would do on life. But to them, it was a one-to-many problem, right? It was like you were literally, it was still the three channels with three broadcasters thing, which is still interesting. And a lot of what the internet does is a continuation of that. But I think the fact that it's now a many-to-many conversation, the fact that this phone that I'm holding for those who are listening, right, is now like the eyes and ears of the world could potentially be in my pocket and vice versa. I am in the pocket of anybody in the world, right? That changes that dynamic in a big way. And I think, yeah, part of what it creates is the media fragmentation. And I think, again, I don't mean this in necessarily like this super Machiavellian cynical way, but you do need a coherent narrative. We're a country of what, 330 plus million on a continent spanning four time zones. There has to be a shared narrative to make this thing go. Yeah. And right now it's, and arguably it's better to have a coherent or at least consistent and comprehensive, slightly false narrative than it is to have literally this din of a thousand competing narratives, at least when it comes to group action. So that's my one fear, right? That, this is a bigger thing that I've been obsessed about, the question of like textual cultures versus oral and visual cultures. But it just seems that like getting back to Gutenberg, the world that Gutenberg created was still a gatekept world to a certain degree, less gatekept potentially than the sort of Catholic world that preceded it, but nonetheless still gatekept. And that allowed action at a distance, right, in a way, and the thought of a coherent narrative that was span a continent in a way that, you know, the monks in the scriptoria would be at pains to sort of do. Although they managed it pretty well. The Catholic world was fairly large and was pretty uniquely on message. But yeah, I think I think this is one of these things that shakes out. I don't know. Anyhow, we're kind of veering off. I don't want to take the interview in a weird direction.
This is actually why it's one of the conversations which is useful to go in a weird direction, because the thing that I'm curious about, the key thing once again for non-history buffs, is that the 30 Years' War culminates in the Peace of Westphalia, which then gives us the nation state. Then have this rule that, hey, if Germany or Holy Roman Empire, it's complicated. Basically, if France wants to be Catholic and Germany wants to be kind of Protestant and Denmark wants to do whatever the Danes are doing, that's okay. The Pope just can't interfere and Protestants can't impose their will on other nations. That's how that shakes out, quote unquote. How do you think, or how could you see, because I'm not asking for a prediction because everyone hates predictions, how can you see our virtual social media conflict, tribalization stuff, because you write about tribes a lot. This is also another fascinating thing we'll get into. How do you see that possibly shaking out? Like, what is the consensus where not everyone wins? Because the nation state wasn't a win for everybody, right. But it's a conclusion.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny you mentioned the nation state, because again, that I think, yeah, you're right that that's one of the logical outcomes of this textual revolution, right? Among others, right? You know, objective truth, compendia of knowledge like the encyclopedists, which again, now an encyclopedia is almost a completely banal thing, but at one point it was a school of philosophy that thought that you could actually encompass the world's knowledge. It was kind of revolutionary at the time, right? The thought of like looking up and getting the right answer, right, is a revolutionary thought that certainly didn't exist in pre-textual cultures. And before you had mass literacy and a mass media, there was no way to do such a thing. Like the concept didn't even exist. You lived in fragmented epistemologies, right, in which like my truth, not to sound like some like emo college student going on about their childhood or something, but like my truth as whatever, a Northern Spanish peasant, which is where my family's from, was fundamentally different than even a Southern Spanish peasant, whatever. But it didn't matter. They couldn't even talk to each other. Information didn't move that fast. It just didn't matter. But anyhow, one thing that comes out of that textual world, right, that in which you can have an objective notion, you can have a notion of written constitution, you can have elections, right, you can have speeches people read, and they feel that somebody in northwestern Spain, again, a little village where my family's from, felt in some sense like they belonged to somebody in Madrid so they could participate in this larger national whole. You're right, the nation state comes out of that, right? The notion of a fixed language with a grammar and a syntax. Remember, like the foundation of the nation state was also the foundation of what we call French, what we call Spanish, what we call Italian, what we call German, right? Like when Germany and Italy are younger than the United States, when they were sort of formed as national entities, they had to settle on a linguistic standard, which in Germany, curiously, was Martin Luther's German from this translated Bible. In the case of Italy, was Dante and Petrarch and whatnot. I mean, but even now in Spain, you still see fragmentation, right? It's getting back. I don't know why my family's into this, but in Galicia, where my family's from, they speak a different language, right? And for a long time under the fascist dictator of Spain, it was actually illegal to teach that language, right? Because again, the notion of creating a nation is the notion of imposing a language that we now call Spanish, but even in Spanish is actually usually called Castilian, the language of Castile, not the language of Spain as an entity, right? And so anyhow, this nation state comes out of this whole culture, and you're right. How does that interact with the world, which once again, I can speak to anybody in the world kind of unfettered. I don't know. That's one of the things that worries me, right? Because if you were to ask me like, what's the biggest thing that's happened in the past 200 years? I mean, the internet's up there, but I think really the big thing, like the moment in 2001 when like the monolith is there and like, you know, we the chimps are like get all excited because holy shit, like something major has happened, is really the decoupling of bits and atoms of information from stuff moving around the world, right? Which, I mean, I don't know how old you are, Marsh, but you seem younger than me. And I'm guessing okay. Well, you're a very youthful looking 30. I would have guessed less, but you might still be part of the bridge generation. I'm definitely part of the bridge internet generation that was like raised in an analog world, but then of course came to adulthood in the digital world. So I feel obviously comfortable in this world, but I remember what it was like, right? Like I still have letters from my parents in college time that you would like write a thing on a piece of paper and put a stamp on it. And like, that's the fastest that most people would communicate. And they get an answer 4 days late. Like it was that slow, right? And now we've decoupled those things. The way things move and the way you get information about the world is disconnected, right? And that's unusual, right? Like, again, it's...
How is that different from... I'm non-technical. How is that different from the internet?
It's been an evolutionary process, right? That's the thing, right? If you read, you know, historians like to create clean breaks and create periods and everything seems like a step change. But if you look just aside a random example, the Greeks, it took them 300 years to really properly adopt the alphabet from around 700 BC to like 400 some odd BC, right? It, like literally the alphabet took three centuries, longer than the US has been around, to actually get adopted as like, yes, we're fully a textual company, society. And so how did this start? It's funny, both of them started decoupling when both started getting faster, right? When the railroad started being built across the United States, which was a novelty at the time, they put in the telegraph right next to it because it was just more convenient. Marshall McLuhan actually gets this in his books. Again, just to give you the idea, it's like it takes the supreme effort to realize the obvious thing in front of you. So I cite these historical examples just to try to jar people out of their expectation, right? The world didn't have time zones until the 19th century because neither people nor information moved fast enough that it mattered. Like right now we ask the question, I go to my little time and go, what time is it in New York? Or Marshall, are you in Central Time? I need to know what time that is. That didn't matter a century ago because you and I, nothing would move fast enough such that I had to know what fucking time it was in your place.
2 hours, just, 3 hours, wouldn't matter.
It doesn't matter. I mean, clocks, it takes me a while, like how did the world work? Clocks, and most people didn't have a clock or a watch. It was kind of expensive. Clocks were just set to local noon. Local noon means when the sun is highest in your meridian, right? And that your clock was just set to noon when it was literally local noon and that's it. It didn't matter, right? If you look at train timetables for time zones, they literally had all these conversions between the time in Indianapolis versus Columbus versus whatever, because everything was slightly a few minutes apart. It was ridiculous, right? So anyhow, just to give you an example, but that all started in the 19th century and they ushered in time zones because of the railroad, right? Suddenly you needed to know, like we couldn't translate the time schedule to like literally every stop along the damn train tracks. You had to literally say, okay, we're going to take an arbitrary width of time, 15 degrees in the 360 degree thing and call that a time zone. But there's no particular reason why you need that. You can divide it into how many ones in theory you wanted, right? But in any case, you did that because time and matter and information now move so fast, you needed to know that, right? And so that to me is when things start changing, because then you start having a consciousness of things away from you, right? Like, again, it's hard. You have to really sit there and think about, or go into the woods in a cabin, disconnect from everything, which I've also done, to like truly understand what it was like to live back then, right? There's this great, totally overlooked book by a guy named Thomas Dzangetida, or I think I'm pronouncing it Dzang, however you pronounce it. It's kind of a silly name, but that's his name. It's called Mediated. And, you know, he cites the example that probably World War II was the first, like Pearl Harbor was the first time that this business of something, you know, violent, big, historical happening, the JFK assassination, actually. The JFK assassination, safely in the TV age when there's like TVs in every window, like everyone's seen the photo of like Americans standing, looking at a TV in the window, like seeing that JFK died and then crying or whatever, right? Because they were virtually experiencing kind of the trauma of seeing your political leader, you know, assassinated in broad daylight, right? But nobody asked the question, where were you when you heard about Pearl Harbor? Where were you when you heard about the assassination of Franz Ferdinand? The media wasn't there for you to feel connected in a deep emotional way to some traumatic event that happened 6,000 miles away. Like humans didn't even think of the world that way, right? But starting roughly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, certainly now, suddenly our emotional lives, our intellectual lives, our what we are as humans, our little brain space right here is suddenly completely disconnected from your physical proximity and is completely, in this case, wedded to not a TV, which at the end of the day is still one to many, this little box right here. Right? And I would say that changes everything. Your next question is like, well, how do you deal with that politically, right? That to me is the worry, right? Like it's still the case that the world is divided into little colored squares called cities and states and countries and whatnot that actually define the values and laws and economies and all the rest of it that you physically live in, right? So until like the singularity happens and we're all just pure information on some hard drive somewhere, this disconnect between your physical environment and your intellectual and mental and emotional environment, in my mind, is extraordinarily problematic. And that to me is like, it's one of these seismic friction points, right? The mental, I mean, I know it sounds a little bit Gnostic, like the carnal versus the spiritual, but it is the physical versus the cognitive and their decoupling that I think, you know, causes, a lot of the turmoil that we see around us.
What's so interesting, the way you're articulating this, if I'm comparing bits and atoms, 19th century with the internet, it seems like your articulation, especially focusing on time zones, that's a centralizing feature. You're now tying Columbus and Cleveland. We're stretching the limits of my Midwestern geography, so I'll stop there. Columbus, yeah. Cleveland, and there's Toledo. I got three. That's good enough. Together into a more unified polity. Once again, you have the shared experience. Actually, JFK is such a great example because that is a unifying moment in the sense that, not even from a patriotism perspective, but everyone experiences that same moment together the same way. But with the internet going from chat forums or chat, you know, or just even a, you know, a room back in the 1990s to today with various different social media segments, that is a experience or technology that pushes people away from something centralized. So I'm just curious, what do you think about the whole debate around whether centralization is good? You don't really hear many people advocating for centralization, but you see a lot of people, especially on Twitter, advocating for decentralization. They tend to be people who are into crypto. How do you think about that debate?
Yeah. I mean, now we're safely venturing into Balaji land, right? So Balaji, and I hate to, I'm not using him as a punching bag. I mean, I consider him a friend and we chatted stuff. So I'm not hostile to his ideas, but, you know, although he's often very strident in expressing them, but his idea, just to sort of recapitulate what he's saying, and I don't consider myself a crypto expert, so I'm guessing there's crypto people who might take issue with the very basic explanation, but his take on not just, you know, what's called DeFi, decentralized finance, or decentralized everything, right? The notion that there is a central bank or a central banking system or a central government, right? A lot of this analog world, again, which is tied to these colored squares on the map called the state of California or the United States of America, or whatever, right? That if we get rid of that and virtualize a lot of those services, right, via the blockchain or whatever, then we can escape the trap, right? We don't like everyone in California who, like, if you believe in the sort of cold Civil War theory of American politics right now, where like everyone, like we should just like schedule some sort of divorce. Not that you could, of course, because it's not really blue states and red states. It's really almost down to the zip code, right? So there's no way you could actually disentangle this. But if you believe that that's an inevitable result, well, one way around it would be to have everyone in the respective little color bucket just, you know, belong to a different decentralized community. And that's it, right? Like they don't have to get along anymore. You can pick your little island. We're almost like in Second Life or some other virtualized form or Grand Theft Auto or whatever, some other sort of immersive game in which we all just, you know, life becomes like Minecraft effectively, but, you know, in its fullest realization. So anyhow, that in very broad brush strokes, that's the argument. I mean, I think it's very neat and elegant. It certainly seems to solve the problem, right? At least in theory, but it's still the case that like someone needs to like fix the toilet when it's broken, or if, you know, the supply chains are screwed up, then like someone needs to fix it. Or, you know, I hate to, you know, raise the specter because it's kind of a whatever, but like, you know, the barbarians or whatever who aren't like signed on to the decentralization paradigm, like who's going to form the perimeter and like get them the hell out of
Taiwan,
there?
I don't think the CCP is particularly signed on to this thesis.
Or somebody in this camp buys some enormous piece of land in Nevada or something and forms their own autonomous little unit in it. Well, A, the state of Nevada may not smile on that depending on what you actually do, right? And then two, even if they do, you know, it's still going to be problematic. You're still tied to a piece of land, even if the scope of control is way more granular than the state of Nevada or the United States of America. So I just find it, I don't know, again, until we actually really virtualize like our lives, like my brain, my consciousness is running on silicon, I don't understand how this is going to work. But maybe I'm looking at it in a binary fashion, and there is some set point between now and the singularity that could actually be a steady state. I'm not sure.
Well, the thing is, this is why everyone across these various debates is obsessed with the printing press example, because what someone, and I don't, we've had Balaji on the podcast a couple of times, and
did you?
I both agree and disagree with what he's saying, but I think the Balaji position would basically be just in the same way that the Catholic Church over a centuries long time scale was not resistant to the technological advances caused by the printing press. There's nothing, once people can read, you can't enforce Latin mass in the same way. Once people can read, you can't do this, and that. So to what degree
add to that for a second, a bit of the history. So the Catholic Church resisted it for a long time, and then they started their own printing press. And in fact, our current, I don't know if you're familiar with the etymology of the word propaganda, it actually comes from the Catholic office that ran the presses. It was called I forget the exact Latin, but it's the office for the propagation. Propaganda means propagation, the propagation of the faith. And so they decide after they fought Facebook, they started a Facebook page effectively and started running like counter narrative against the Lutheran narrative. And that's, so even the Catholic Church didn't just sit there, right? I mean, they still exist. They've still got over a billion users, right? They still have over a billion MAUs. Christianity is still the largest religion in the world. And so so they adapted as well, right? So I get, anyhow, sorry to interrupt you. You were finishing.
No. So here's the, well, this builds from that then. To what degree do you think the state is resistant to technology? Sorry, once again, let me put it more precisely. To what degree is the state resistant to the implications of the internet, the blockchain, decentralization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, there's a famous story of, I think it was Faraday, who gave a lecture at the Royal Society to British politicians or something, 19th century, about electromagnetism. And they looked totally bored. And they said, Faraday, who cares? Like, why should we care about it? And he said, well, sir, one day perhaps you can tax it. So although I think that the government is probably taxing tech a lot these days, they don't actually pay that much in corporate taxes, depending on how much of the P&L they take through their Irish entity. But in any case, how anti-tech? Yeah, I think, I mean, looking, forget, you know, taking off our world historical hats for a second, right? And just looking a little slightly more tactically, I feel there's been a real shift in power between like the old school Eastern Seaboard establishment of like DC and New York, which means like old school media, finance, government, like all that old world shit, basically, right? That I don't
just
even feel
like context. I just moved from DC to New York, so I cannot escape my East Coast.
Dude, you're part of the you're part of the Acela corridor. This is the problem here in the US versus the West Coast. That like when I launched Pull Request, the first hobby version of it years ago, I started with some surely grandiose and sanctimonious sounding post that said something like, the West holds all the cards now, right? Like, who gives a shit about Hollywood? It's all Netflix. Tesla's market cap is, I don't know what the multiple is at this point, of all the other auto companies put together, right? Facebook and Twitter is where the conversation's happening. It's not, who cares about NBC, right? Like, NBC only matters to the point they get to the extent that they get engagement on Facebook, right? Fox News is what it is because it gets massive engagement on Facebook, you know, whether you like it or not, whether it's right or not, right? And so I think there's this bizarre unbalance in the system, right? And from the little time that I spent in the East Coast establishment, I have to say it still feels like a foreign country to me. I was raised sort of in the South, but really in Miami, which is kind of a different world. And I lived 3 years in New York and I worked at an investment bank. So I kind of know that world and met some of those people. I felt like a total outsider the entire time. And I just, from what I know, you know, from what I felt I knew at that time, those people and their way of thinking is pretty antithetical to the West Coast way of thinking that tends to be less institutional, more irreverent, more disruptive, more willing to try crazy shit, you know, more willing to, you know, entertain dumb notions, to be honest, right? You know, all these bizarre fads that a lot of techies do around fasting or, I don't know, taking modafinil, who knows, like all the weird shit that techies do. And it's less than people say it is, but it's definitely not zero, right? So all that stuff is true. And I think there's just the way that somebody like Zuck, from the way, you know, to the extent I can channel him having worked for him years ago, thinks about the world is very different than your like Harvard grad guy who's like a DC apparatchik or some consultant or finance guy in New York. They look at the world very, very fundamentally different. And yeah.
To what degree can East Coast establishment, DC, New York, Acela Corridor, everything I hold dear, to what degree can we absorb lessons from the West? Because I think the thing that West Coast triumphalists, because I'm from Portland, Oregon too, so I'm really just mixing.
Oh, really? Oh, well,
yeah. So I've divided loyalties here. The thing that West Coasters underestimate is it's been 10 years, right? Like this isn't, it's not as if everyone is just sort of triumphantly enjoying their time on Wall Street or management consulting the way they were. Totally different space just over the past 10 years since I graduated from high school and all of that. So to what degree do you think it's possible that DC, New York, Boston can pick up lessons from less hierarchical structures? Because even compare the East Coast to the East Coast of the 50s and the 60s, right? There's a reason why Mad Men sticks out even to people in New York City. Right. Things do change. There's just a huge lag. So I'm just curious how you think about that part.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the frog has been boiled a little bit and we're just not noticing it because we're in it, right? And like, if you were to compare New York now to 10 years ago, you would think, oh my God, right? I'm sure like Facebook was openly mocked and joked about 10 years ago. And I mean, I remember it being talked about when I was in a Wall Street trading floor and everyone thought it was a joke, right? I remember somebody left for Facebook and they're like, what the fuck, this is so stupid. And I'm sure that guy made way more money than anybody did on the trading desk, right? And I'm guessing that perception has changed. So yeah, maybe there's change there, but it's still a go West young man sort of country where people go to the West I think it's changing slightly. Like I think tech has gotten to the point where like it is now the first stop in the like, you know, Ivy League elite pipeline in a way that certainly wasn't 10 years ago, certainly not when I joined tech, right? But still, I don't know, things still just seem wilder and freer out here. California is weird though, right? In that, I mean, and this is, it's true if you look at the settlement of the West, California developed a lot faster, even though it's further west, right? Like you think of things having gone west, but actually no, California, there's this great book called 2 Years Before the Mast. That's about, speaking of people from the East going west, it was a Harvard undergrad who's had failing eyesight. And for, you know, back in the 19th century, doctors gave strange recommendations. Yeah. And they gave, you know, they said, oh, go out and, you know, spend more time outdoors to improve your eyesight. So he signed up as a common seaman on a ship that was going from the East Coast to the West Coast, which would go around at the time, obviously before the canal, would go around the Cape Horn, which was super dangerous, and then traded up and down what was then still Mexican territory, right? And so, you know, it was in the 1840s, right? And, you know, San Francisco, it was pre-gold rush, so San Francisco didn't even exist. It was still Yerba Buena or whatever. And, but in any case, that soon changed, right? So California developed a lot faster than the rest of the West, right? So like I'm spending a lot of time and officially have moved to Reno, Nevada, and Nevada feels way more like whatever Mad Max fantasy you have of the West, it's still alive in Nevada in a way that it is not alive in California, right? And so in some sense, long way of saying California feels more like the East Coast than other parts of quote unquote the West, right? Like parts of the West are still the frontier. I think California perhaps has become less of that. Certainly in the big city has become less of that. Because again, it's not like, look, at this point, it's not like we're talking about two totally different sets of people, the elites at Facebook versus, you know, McKinsey. Like yeah.
I know a lot of SF to DC, DC to SF people. So that's that part. And I have to ask you the obvious question. What is your quick take on is San Francisco over? Obviously, depending on how much people in the audience are on Twitter, there's obviously a high degree. I never know. You know what I mean? Like it's hard from the outside because by one version of Twitter, Miami's the sickest thing ever. New York looks pretty cool this week.
Let's SF light this up, Marshall. Let's bring on the totally controversial takes that's going to make this blow up with 10,000 likes. SF is over. New York bagels suck. And Miami is the future or whatever. Is SF over? So I think one misperception here, I hate being that well actually guy from Twitter, but I'll be the well actually guy in this perception. There's a misperception that like SF equals Silicon Valley. Yeah. And that's just not true. Like either in the lived reality of it now or even historically, right? Like Silicon Valley, for those who aren't familiar with California geography, is not San Francisco. It's like 40 miles south of here. There actually is a valley. You can actually see it, which is where a lot of the tech companies started and what used to be apple orchards kind of around Stanford and whatnot because of the defense industry in the 50s and 60s and integrated circuits. And anyway, the whole long history, a bunch of books you can read about it. This is not Silicon Valley, strictly speaking. That said, starting roughly 10 years ago, a lot of tech companies did move here and sprout here, like Airbnb and Uber and Twitter, obviously, right? So it's definitely become part of that constellation. So what used to be like, if anything, people used to work in Silicon Valley and then live in the city if they were like cool and hip and wanted a big city, but then they'd commute like crazy, right? Like the flow would be south at the beginning of the day. Now it's not necessarily clear anymore. Like on the contrary, maybe now some of Silicon Valley is actually a better community for San Francisco. So in any case, long story short, SF doesn't equal Silicon Valley. So San Francisco can die as a place to create tech companies. Like if the current crop of like incumbents, Airbnb, Stripe, whatever move, doesn't mean Silicon Valley's over. It just means that maybe San Francisco isn't integrated into that tech economy in the very direct way it was in the past. But not that I'm that old or I've been around that long, but I've been living in the Bay Area for roughly 20 years. And, you know, back in the first tech boom, there weren't that many tech companies. San Francisco didn't equal tech. My first tech job was as an intern in grad school, and I had to drive all the way to Foster City, right? Like, I don't even know where I would have gotten a tech internship in the city at that point. There's no major company in the city, right? And so I think San Francisco faces lots of headwinds. I think lots of people are thinking of leaving. The crime is through the roof. It's too damn expensive, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't mean Silicon Valley tech's going to go away. It's just not going to happen within the 7x7 mile thing that's called San Francisco.
It is. It's funny. We have the two Wall Street Journal reporters who authored a book, an upcoming book on WeWork, coming on the show next week. And I remember I was in a clubhouse room with you and someone referred to WeWork as a Silicon Valley company. And you very aggressively were like, no, that was New York. Okay. People in SV didn't invest. So I just, as I'm prepping for that show right now, I think of you whenever I think of just this idea of like, what actually is quote unquote Silicon Valley? What actually is technology? It's just a funny bit that comes out.
It's a good question. I mean, and the other thing that also I go into a frothing rage about is like Theranos, right? We've all forgotten or partially forgotten. Speaking of Wall Street Journal reporters, John Carreyrou, who did amazing reporting actually, and kind of burst the bubble, this thing, Bad Blood on Theranos, which was apparently a fraud. And they were actually based in Silicon Valley, but almost the entire cap table was actually non-Silicon Valley money. Like every Silicon Valley VC, almost every Silicon Valley VC, with the exception of, I think, Perkins, like passed on the deal. Like nobody in Silicon Valley funded that company. They just happened to be here. But they definitely, you know, they got some of the glimmer from the SV gold, so to speak. But I without sounding a little bit too foofy, I'm going to sound like a total SV tech bro here, but like Silicon Valley is definitely kind of a state of mind, right? In the sense, in the same way that like American culture is like a state of mind. Like you can't point to American culture, like French culture is like Notre Dame and a croissant or something, right? Like there's not a lot of American culture you could point to say, that's America. But there's definitely an American state of mind. You kind of know when you feel it, right? I think Silicon Valley is in the same way, that there's not a lot of there. Like people come to Silicon Valley, oh, let me go see Silicon Valley. Again, there's not the Eiffel Tower somewhere we just go hang out in, right? But there's a certain state of mind that maybe it's hard to experience as a tourist, but it's definitely a thing. And I think that is getting exported, right? And like, if you have enough Silicon Valley people moving to Miami, and I don't have a strong opinion on Miami, yes or no, but but if you have that mentality exported, it's possible that you could boot up the software on different hardware potentially, right? But I think it's hard to do. One of the things I did, for as much as I might talk about Europe, I'm actually a European citizen, right? I have a Spanish passport in addition to the US one, and I've lived there. Actually, I wrote the beginning of Chaos Monkeys in Europe, thinking I'd end up moving there. And you know, every major city in Europe has like a Silicon whatever, Silicon Sentier in Paris or Silicon Alley in Berlin or whatever. They're all trying to recreate the Silicon Valley magic, and almost all of them are failing, with the exception of London potentially, right? Or Stockholm maybe.
London has some other things going on too, so it's
right. No, about. Right. Well, right. It's, you know, that little village called London, right, that hasn't played a role in the past 300 years of history. But you know, these other cities that historically have not been technological, you know, they kind of do everything right. Like the local governments actually fund stuff in ways that they don't hear at all, right? And like, They obviously have the talent and the educated populace that could be designers and PMs, but somehow just never quite take, and they speak all the right language. It almost feels like a cargo cult in the South Pacific. Like they do all the things to make like the magic planes come out of the sky, and somehow the Google and Facebook planes never land on their landing strips. So I think it's hard to do, right? But I think it can be done. And I think particularly with COVID, like that's another thing. Like I'm not quite sure how much of it is real versus like me fooling myself with my circle, but it seems like a lot of people have left the Bay Area under COVID. I'm not quite sure how many of them are coming back, right? Like some of the people who are like VCs or people who are CEOs and can sort of run their company almost as they want, I think a lot of those people are not coming back actually. And a lot of them have moved to Utah, Nevada, Texas, Florida, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, why would I go back and just deal with that bullshit? Like why, you know? And so, that said, right, I think if you're younger, there is an element of FOMO. Look, you know, San Francisco still has lots of charm. So does New York, I'm sure. And it's like, well, you want to be part of this urban center. You don't have a family. You haven't have life figured out yet. Like, you know, you want to get in the mix. You want to get into the weird circus of like young urban professional life, which I certainly did in my 20s and 30s. And I could see that, right? You're not going to move to St. George, Utah, which is a perfectly nice town, by the way. Southern Utah is gorgeous, but I don't think you'd like go there straight out of college thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to make a life there. Right. So I don't know. I could see it going either way. I think the hybrid approach to me sounds difficult. Having worked in tech for a while, and I did the remote thing for a year and a half at my previous startup. It's like, if everyone's remote, it can work. Certainly if everyone is remote in the entire tech sector, it can definitely work. It's just like the default. Like we just have to do it. Our competition's going to do it too. It's like, whatever. We're on like even playing field, right? But if your competition doesn't have to do it, if it's hybrid, some people are in the office, some people aren't, I can see it being a real pain in the ass. And I can see it binarizing into either like, no, we are not doing work from home, or, you know, max one day a week or something, it's in office, or it's full remote. The hybrid, I think it's going to be difficult for companies to do. But.
So we've got two last things here, because the thing that I want the audience to pick up is that you are obviously an autodidact and are very well read, but you also have a lot of experience and expertise in the advertising field. And you made a big claim on Substack today, which we're taping on July 6th for context, that we are, I actually have a quote somewhere. Advertising is going through a once in a generation transformation. And to zoom out for a second, if we actually go to the debates about Substack, whether or not the New York Times is truly a success or not, whether Facebook and Twitter are toxic, actually a lot of the things have to do with advertising, which isn't the sexiest thing, obviously. So it'd just be great for you to just give the full context on your thoughts on advertising.
Yeah, it's not sexy, but you know what? It pays for everything, right? It's like, you know, advertising is the internet, like, you know, petroleum is to Saudi Arabia. It's like, it may not be sexy, but it pays for everything. So, you know, every once in a while, you kind of have to dip your toe into it, even if you aren't an ad tech person. So yeah, so thanks for plugging my piece. It's the first in a series on ads, data, and privacy, something that I've like done professionally for the past 10 plus. Like I've worked in ad tech. I've basically been turning human eyeballs and data and pixels into money for like 12 years, which is a long time in Silicon Valley years. And we are in my opinion, I'm not the only one who thinks this, by the way, it's not a totally unique thought, that we are in a once in a generation sort of complete refactoring or re-architecting of how the world works, right? If you go back to like the earliest days, look, I'll tell you how old I am without telling you how old I am. First time I saw the web, what people call the internet now, was like in the late 90s, Netscape 3. Whatever. And there'd be that little like spinner thing with like, the end with like meteorites flying by or whatever, sitting there waiting for like a minute for like some junky little page to load. And so that was when I first saw the web, and almost all the plumbing of all the ad tech, everything, the shoes that follow you around, the internet, how, you know, Facebook is worth $1 trillion, like all that shit was actually architected in the paradigm of a little browser with like a little cookie ID thing and everything living in the cloud and your browsing behavior. And like, and even, you know, mobile apps, which technically function very differently than desktop browsers, when it comes down to the fundamental data flows, have been architected the same way, right? Like you do things on your phone, on your device, it goes into this cloud that you have very, very little visibility into. Stuff happens, some of it totally legit, a lot of it sketchy, right? And then you get like an ad or an experience or a news feed or whatever that comes out of it, right? And you create more data and it goes into the cloud, more shit happens, and then on it goes, right? And that's fine for desktop route, like that's probably how it should have been architected. But we're in a world where like, this is like an iPhone, whatever it is, the most recent, the 12 or something. It's like, this would have been considered like the most highest end computer, like I don't even know how many years ago to do this, the direct comparison, but certainly 15 or 20 years ago when this was all architected, this was an impossible idea, like even on a desktop, right? So the question is like, why the hell are we doing all this bizarre loading of data, all this back and forth, when there's like real code on a real computer running on your pocket? Like, why on earth would you do all the computation in the cloud? Like, it's not obvious. It's not obviously a better way to do things. Like, now, of course, if you talk to like, and I've done this to engineers at big companies you can name, like Google and Apple, and you know, say like, you say what I just said, you get a lot of pushback because like, well, we've been doing this for 15 years and the company makes over $100 billion a year on it. Like, what are you talking about? Like, yes, but there's this little thing called privacy, right? And privacy is an interesting concept. Like, you could write a whole book on it, but privacy is a strange thing, right? Like I, as a footnote in my piece, I mentioned the modern version of the word privacy wasn't even used or documented as used until 1814, right? Before that, it meant the state of solitude. It didn't actually mean like what we think of privacy now is like, you know, the right to live as a stranger among strangers with control over my data. That is a very extraordinarily recent coinage. Even as a legal principle, it was more or less invented by Louis Brandeis in 1890 in this very readable and still great piece called The Right to Privacy, in which he basically invented it. You know, the word doesn't even appear once in the Constitution, right? There was no notion of privacy really before the sort of modern age. And if you ask why, well, what was magical 1890, getting back to things like atoms and bits and new technology? Two things. One, it was literally Kodak had shipped their like Brownie or whatever it's called, their cheap little camera that anybody could buy a few years before 1890, actually, such that like photography was suddenly cheap. And then two, the telegraph and wire services had started, such that something that happened in New York could be read about like with a photo potentially in Kansas City, right? But, you know, within a day, which was, again, a completely unprecedented act. And specifically in the case of Brandeis, his law partner, who was kind of a socialite, had been, you know, paparazzi started, right? Like, you know, people, you know, the same way that like, you know, like a TikTok goes viral, their equivalent was like a photo of so-and-so dining with so-and-so in such a restaurant. And oh my God, and that was like the crazy scandalous TikTok. That started happening, right? And so Brandeis more or less created the notion of privacy, right? And every legal precedent in privacy that gets quoted is from his post on, right? And so, you know, and my point is not necessarily to delegitimize the notion of privacy. I think it's like, it's a necessary cope in our current world, but just to be clear, it's a cope, right? Like in our ancestral, like I used to live in a small island in the Northwest in a little town, and there's no privacy there. Nobody has privacy. Everyone knows who you are. Everything knows who you're sleeping with, who's the asshole, who, you know, whatever. Everyone, there's only one grocery store to shop at, so everyone knows what you're eating. Like there's no privacy, right? And guess what? You feel better about, like, there's actually a feeling of you being messed in a social fabric that's actually welcoming. People choose to live in that world, even though people who are used to this urban life maybe find it a little claustrophobic, many don't, right? So point being, with the urbanization and industrialization of everything, we invented privacy, right? But like, you know, in the Code of Hammurabi, there's no privacy rights. This is not like our sort of fundamental right at the life and liberty level that humans have been thinking about since forever, which again, doesn't mean that it's garbage. It just means that, well, it's ill-defined, right? And it's very adaptive to the situation. And so I think the notion of how humans think about their privacy is changing in big ways, right? Like, and in ways that frankly, a lot of the privacy advocates, I think, don't quite understand. Like the reality is that Facebook's usage hasn't gone down despite all of its little privacy scandals. Like maybe it's gone down slightly just because people don't use Facebook that much anymore. They use Instagram more or WhatsApp or whatever, right? Like the industry is changing. But you know, if you actually plotted like Facebook's usage graph all throughout these various privacy scandals, and back when I was a bigger troll, I used to post this just to fucking, you know, just to troll like the New York Times people, you know, you would see no bump whatsoever. Like, where's the privacy scandal according to Facebook? No, nobody, in terms of what they're actually doing, nobody actually cared, right? Now, it's not totally true. It doesn't mean they're indifferent, right? I think there's this scholar at Stanford, is it Helene? Her last name is Nissenbaum, and she has this notion of contextual privacy. The idea being that most humans think about privacy in a contextual way. Like you go to the doctor, right? You get treated, you get looked at. Obviously you generate health data, right? Some of it could even be digital data, right? But, and you compromise your privacy for the sake of like your doctor helping you. And, you know, the doctor said, you know what? There's this radiologist in some other X, Y, and Z place. I want to send him images so he can look at them so you can get better care. I think 99% of humans would say, well, yeah, fuck yeah, whatever. Like whatever it takes to make you understand what's going on better, of course. Now, the doctor said, oh, by the way, I'm going to sell your data, to a pharmaceutical company so that they can target you for, you know, cardiac pills because I know you're going to have a heart attack. You'd be like, no, right? And so that's the thing. So humans, privacy is not an absolute, all this is, oh, privacy is an absolute human right. No, it isn't. Sorry. Even the rights enshrined in the Constitution are not absolute. We don't have absolute free speech in this country, right? There's restrictions around it, right? And there are, and I think most humans would agree to compromise for their privacy in exchange for things like convenience, a feeling of community, right? Like living in a small town or you've got your
free things. It's not just convenience, it's like free. That's basically what we think of as free is us exchanging.
Well, there's also that. Yeah.
For that. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that makes people feel a little queasy, but yeah, that's right. I mean, you're getting, you know, Facebook is expensive to run. People don't realize it, but it's like Facebook, well, it used to be at least, is like a quarter of the third of the internet in most countries that where it's viral, right? That's expensive, right? It's not free. And so that's it. People reply, like, well, I'd be willing to pay for it. Maybe people would. I don't. The thing is, when you've got network effects, it's hard to charge for things because everyone has to be on the network for it to have value, right? And so you basically have to make it free. And so in viral situations where there are network effects, you can't. I can't think of a consumer app with strong network effects that actually charges for its service. It doesn't exist, basically, as far as I can tell. If one of your listeners finds a counterexample I haven't thought about, I'd love to hear about it. But I don't know of one. And so, yeah, privacy is a malleable entity. Like, again, it's a right worth respecting. You have to build around it, but it's not an absolute right. And getting back to your ad thing, what's going on with privacy? Well, I mean, just to say it out loud, the Europeans have jumped into the game, right? And legislated with GDPR. California has a thing called CCPA, which is similar, not exactly the same, but it's roughly similar, in which it grants users a lot of control they probably don't want, right? For example, raise your hand if you would love a button that just opts into every bullshit little pop-up and every website you go to that constantly says we've got cookies, whatever. Has anyone in the history of the world ever said no to any of those? Said, oh, well, I was going to go to that website, but you know what? I read their policy and like, no, I'm just not going to read it. Of course not. Everyone says yes. It's dumb, right? So yes, you get a measure of control, but guess what? Control isn't that great necessarily. And I think most of us would sign up for just clicking yes all the time because who cares, right? But like it or not, GDPR is what GDPR is. And even though the EU is a relatively small market, it's not tiny. And so it can sort of regulate the world that way. And even if it doesn't, right, CCPA regulates California and all these companies are in California. So one way or the other, they're kind of stuck. And so you have to build systems in a different way. And the weird thing is that like so much of this privacy conversation is like, oh, more, you know, if X privacy is good, 2X privacy is better. Like, let's just turn the privacy knob up to 11 because like privacy is an inherent good. All privacy all the fucking time. It's like, well, actually, the privacy knob is actually a trade-off. And on the other side of the privacy knob is competition, right? Because if you make it such that, and for the, I mean, I can't, without a whiteboard, I can't wave my arms fast enough to actually illustrate this. But, you know, the way it works is, If you really want to give users control of their privacy on something like a mobile device, given the way things are architected, then the person who controls the mobile device in some sense has to control that data, right? There has to be a central source of trust, whether it be Google or Apple in the case of my iPhone, whatever, or a competitor, whatever. They're, you know, there's third-party OEMs who make Android devices. They sort of have to control the data, right? Which again is maybe better because companies like Google and Apple have a direct relationship with you and they care about you as a business. So they're not going to like obviously screw you over because like it's just not worth it to screw over once for $1,000 phone, right? Like they're going to kind of respect your views. Not that they're totally cynical either. I mean, I'm sure Tim Cook legitimately believes in what he says about privacy. He probably does, right? Which is great. But again, that means that the companies that control the device and control how that data is stored on the device, in some sense, have a relative advantage, right? And so there's a whole world that most people don't think about that I've lived in for the past 12 years of third-party companies that take data and in various ways, you know, try to monetize it or help the advertising and monetization process, right? And a lot of those companies, I have a, there's this thing called the LumaScape. Luma is a boutique investment bank that does a lot of ad tech stuff. And they always have this updated, like, it's just like this board, like this makes your eyes bleed. It is like this board of like little logos of all the logos of all the companies in the ad tech space and how they sit, you know, it's like literally the money on one side and the eyeballs on the other and how the two cross, right? And like every little box along the way where the data or the money stops, right? That whole world, right, doesn't play in a world in which your privacy is kind of maintained by one player and which it lives on your device, which again, it's good for user privacy. Like it's legitimately better for the user. It's not necessarily good for the ecosystem. Maybe the user doesn't care. Okay. But you know, the FTC does, right? Or governments in general, to some degree or another, have some level of antitrust scrutiny such that it's like, well, hold on. Are you telling me that like Google's going to hold all the cards on all of Android, which is 85% of the handset market in the entire world? Well, I mean, potentially, yes, if things are architected certain ways. And so anyhow, that's the trade-off that I was, and I don't directly address it in today's post, but by the time that whoever is probably watching this, hopefully the next post will come out, which I address some of the sort of competition concerns around a lot of where a lot of this privacy stuff is going.
And for the last question, because I think this is the piece that people are certainly going to enjoy the most. I think it's on November 12th. So this was Latino explaining the election. And I actually, yes. I went to a Spanish immersion school. So like Latinx is actually very difficult to pronounce for me. I said Latinx for so long. And it was funny discovering that, but basically I think that piece is just so useful because I think, and you're not the only person who's pointing this out, but if you just take right. the ideas in that piece and then say, given this, who's going to win the 2020 Democratic primary?
Oh my God.
Who is going to win the New York City mayoral primary? Once again, within the Democratic Party, this is very center left to progressive conversation. It's just a really useful summation of all those ideas. So I think it'd just be useful for you to just give a quick pitch for the piece, and then that would be a good place to take out.
Yeah, that piece went super viral. I don't even know how to pronounce this word yet. Do you know how, I'm like, no joke, do you know how to pronounce it? I don't even know how to pronounce
it. It's just Latinx. Like, it's Latinx. It's actually. It's beyond parody Anglo. Literally just right. that. Yeah.
Right. And for those who aren't Spanish speakers, the NX phoneme doesn't exist in Spanish. So they've picked a word that can't be pronounced in the language of the culture it purports to represent, right? It would like literally be picking an unpronounceable word for, you know, I don't know what, you know, Chinese Americans or something, right?
Yeah.
It's like literally like, I for the longest time, I also pronounce it Latinx. I guess it's Latinx. Okay. So yeah, the piece is called Latin Explaining the Election. I think I was making a joke on like Voxplainer or something. And so the issue there, so I was, you know, my parents were Cuban exiles. So my grandparents were Spanish immigrants to Cuba. Communists came, fled to the United States. I was born in the United States, but raised in Miami, which is kind of this weird little Cuban Miami bubble. And, you know, it's strange having been raised there because there Hispanic culture is like dominant, right? Like, you know, they always say, oh, Hispanic, you know, a lot of Hispanic culture here in California, but there it's dominant, right? You can't like, not in a, you know, oh, the service workers, like it, like literally everywhere. Like you can't really hold a white collar job.
Quick highlight. I was actually Sagar and I went there 2 months ago and I've never been tested on my Spanish as much as I have. I went to Subway and I actually needed to translate for a nice Cuban grandmother who couldn't order her Subway meal properly. And taxi, it's actually, cause I actually read your piece where you referred to it almost as a different country.
Yeah.
I didn't understand what you meant by that until I literally went. I was, by the way, I'm in Miami Beach, so it's not as if I'm in this random part of the city.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think most Americans don't quite grok how weird Miami was. I didn't realize how weird it was until, like I like to say, I went to America for college, right? Like I left Miami to go to college. Like I've lived, I've traveled and lived a lot of places in the world. The biggest culture shock of my life was going to college in the Midwest from Miami, realizing, holy shit, I had not been raised in anything like the United States of America. Like I had no idea where it was. But Miami, it's weird, right? It's like the Singapore of Latin America, to use a very gross or very, you know, crude or reductionist analogy, but it is that, right? All the retail and commercial banking in Latin America, all the banks, there's a street called Brickell and all the big logos are there. The entire Brazilian upper middle class goes there for shopping and, you know, play and shopping and vacation, all that. Every upper middle class family in Venezuela back before things got really bad had like an apartment in Bangkok, Miami, and things in case things got bad. Obviously, Cubans, you know, fled there and en masse and created their own sort of reality, even though they've never really a majority. And now certainly they're not anywhere close to majority. They've become kind of like the Jews in New York or the Irish in Boston, right? The sort of like underdog ethnicity that actually runs the place, right? And it's like, recreated the city in its own little weird image, but then it is also totally Americanized, right? Like these people are not going to like go and live in Latin America or go back to Cuba or anything, even though that Castro died, right? So it's a weird like cultural estuary. I'd like to say like an estuary is a place where like salt and fresh water kind of mix. So this is a cultural estuary of like Anglo Protestant American culture and like Hispanic Catholic culture mixing in one city, right? But coming from that world, right, to a world where people use the term, like, again, I'm just going to struggle, Latinx, and think it means something. Like Biden gave a speech in which he mentioned Latinx. That term means nothing, right, in that world. Like, for starters, a lot of like progressive lefty are just obsessed with the whole white privilege person of color. Like they really think that like your average Miami person sits there and like ponders their Latinxness all day or something. It's like, like the relationship of these minorities to like whatever you consider to be the white centroid of American life is not the dominant relationship in their life, right? Like it's really much more. I had a more recent piece called the bus says Belen, which is kind of, I use the metaphor of like the childhood bus that I was on as like a metaphor for what it's like actually being in one of these ethnic tribes that get some level of like cultural or political momentum inside a country and then, you know, or inside this country. And then you live in kind of your own little tribe, right? And like the primary way you look at the world is like, are they in the tribe? Are they on the bus or are they off the bus, right? And like the mainstream world, sure, it exists in this abstract way, but it's not really a subject of concern in any realm, particularly in Miami, where like there's so much momentum that, again, you can just not see it, right, when you're sitting inside Miami. And so that's the thing that like, I don't know. I'm very skeptical of terms like Latinx. For starters, they're inaccurate, right? Like your Tejano Mexican guy on the border region of Mexico has very little, if anything, in common with your Cuban guy, who has nothing in common with your New York Puerto Rican guy. And there's no judgment or anything there. It's just, there's just different cultures that only seem similar from the outside world, right? The notion of a Latino vote, what does that even mean, right? Because if you talk to the Cuban grandma who wasn't ordering at Subway and got her political opinions, they'd be very different than somebody who also has the last name Garcia somewhere else. And so I'm all for making abstractions that help you make predictions about the world, because the world's just too complex. Like, you know, everyone's sorry.
Kind of not talking, that's kind of this episode, exactly. Right? How do we abstract this down?
right. Like everyone isn't some beautiful little snowflake. Like I'm sure 90% of my decisions could be like figured out by some linear model with like six factors and that's it, right? But the question is like, well, should the Latino or the Latinx, you know, bit be a categorical feature in that little, you know, linear regression model? I don't think it would predict much, to be honest, right? I mean, maybe.
Well, whether you use it or not would actually predict quite a bit, right? In an interesting way, right? So not as a category, but as do you use it is a, it actually tells a lot there.
Yeah, I'd love to see, not that anyone ever does, I'd love to see a survey of people who have actually used the word Latinx at least twice in the past month. Like, what's their average level of education? What's their median income? And like, I just want a geo map of where they're distributed, right? And I'm guessing it's like median income of at least 100K, like 90% have a bachelor's degree or more. And it's like literally like New York, LA, San Francisco, and that's it, right? And literally the most Hispanic parts of the United States, nobody uses the damn term. But look, I mean, this is, and I always sound like some crazy, like Howard Zinn Bernie-crat or some like anti-American European when I say this, but you know, one of the privileges, one of the good things about being raised in a weird bubble like Miami, right, is like you're a little bit outside like the standard mainstream American bubble. And maybe you felt this too. Maybe Portland back in the day was also a little bit outside of it too. But it's like, this is like, it's ultimate imperial American privilege to never see the horizons or the limits to your worldview. Like everything you see and interact with at a cultural, political, economic level, in some sense reflects your own biases and your own framing of the world, right? And so Biden and his entire voting base can watch him use the term Latinx and it doesn't seem laughably absurd to them, right? Because in some sense they just never bump up against little cultural memes that say, this is dumb, this is dumb, this is dumb, right? And the same way, like I was looking at somebody trying to frame you know, the Israeli-Palestine conflict as part of the whole, you know,
colonial
white
POC racial history.
It's like,
yeah.
It's like, dude, like, it's like, and it's just like, you know, to a man with a hammer sort of thing, everything looks
quick
like a
story.
Nail.
You'll appreciate this. So if you can't tell by my last name, I'm adopted. I'm Jewish.
Okay.
The only place in the world where people by default think I'm Jewish is when I go to Israel. Just of course, because, like, once again, because I look, especially with my college age skinniest, I look vaguely Ethiopian. So it's once again, that dynamic there means you cannot just transpose for good or for ill. Obviously, there's all sorts of controversies of Ethiopian Jews, nothing simple. But I think that anecdote right there demonstrates that you cannot just impose Jim Crow era American policy and racism debates onto Israel today.
That's funny. I was wondering where the Kozlov thing is, because it sounded vaguely Jew to me. And it's like, yeah. And it's funny. And you mentioned the Israel thing. It's funny because I think one of the other misconceptions about it, I mean, which gets to the thing I just said, right? Which is like, people think Israel is like a white country, right? Because they identify it with the West, right? But if you actually go, I assume you've been to Israel at some point, right? Yeah. Probably you just said you've been to Israel, right? It's like, it's not at all. Like, and this is like 10, 15 years ago. It's probably even less the case now. You go to Tel Aviv, it felt to me like a Latin American city, right? Like, there's a mix of everything.
It's a weird mix of Miami and New York. That was the feeling I had when I went.
Tel Aviv feels a lot like Miami, actually. The beach culture, everything was built kind of 70s in kind of a, you know, shitty way. Everyone's loud and in your face. Everyone's walking around half naked during the hot summer. Like, it has a very Miami vibe to it, but it doesn't exactly scream, you know, white Northern European, you know, culture, at least it didn't to me. And so, which makes it particularly weird when they sort of apply their sort of duality to it, but interesting. Interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, cool. Interesting. So the Israel, I'm going, by the way, as a random plug, I'm traveling to Israel for the high holidays this summer, actually. As a side thing, people often ask me, like, what's this whole Jew thing with Antonio? So I am converting to Judaism because I've got Jewish kids. It's a whole long story. I don't want to make this podcast drag on. Well, I guess, yeah, the first two kids are mentioned, although the Jewy thing isn't mentioned that much. But anyway, I'm going to Israel for the holidays in September. So that should, assuming they let me in, because this whole COVID, the Delta variant is actually hitting them pretty hard. It turns out they might keep the border shut down, but at least hopefully I'll get there by this summer.
And we're all expecting a nuanced and useful post. And I just, before we go, I just want to, because we just pissed off half of the audience with the discussion of Israel and with the Latinx dunking. The point that I'm trying to make here is that people can say whatever they want. That's not the beef I have with it. It's just that when people use these frameworks of history and culture and language to try to understand the world in ways that don't actually tell you anything. And if you look at America's like Hispanic, even Chicano is like a much more useful phrase. If you look at that broad voting block through that framework, you are not going to have useful answers. And I think in your piece, if you just take that piece and say, do upper middle class, center left progressive have an accurate reading of working class Hispanics, Blacks, Asians, et cetera, they literally do not. So don't try to use that as a method for understanding the world, which is basically, I think, what we're trying to do on this episode.
Right. Exactly. I think that's the problem. It's just not predictive. Like, I don't mind categories or like, even if the word wasn't like from the people who are using it, as long as it's predictive, but it isn't. I mean, the weird thing is, look, we're all blinkered by our sort of cultural software that we're carrying, but it just seems odd to me that I guess I always find political asymmetry is kind of interesting, right? Like, everyone, I always try to both sides, everything, or horseshoe theory, whatever. But I think it is the case of left and right. There's certain times where things are kind of asymmetric, right? And, you know, the fact that the left obviously is kind of overtly pro-diversity, pro-tolerance, pro-listening to, you know, minorities or whatever. But like, it's like, okay, well then stop using the term Latinx and like, you know, read some Miami Cube and actually talking about their personal experience, like, you know, my post, for example, or someone in the Texas border counties that flipped for Trump in last election or whatever, right? But like, and then things like, oh, but I did. It's like, well, yeah, but you listen to somebody who went to Yale, right? And like,
okay, so thank you so much for, once again, I'm treading very lightly here, but a dynamic that just is very frustrating to me, and this is the biggest critique of the East Coast, there's plenty of bigger critiques of the East Coast establishment, the Iraq War, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But a beef I have with the East Coast establishment is how, especially in the Ivy, let's just say top 25 schools in the country dynamic, it is, I'm trying to find the right word for this, but it just subsumes everything. So it takes a Caribbean immigrant who's Black, or an African immigrant who's Black, or an African American descendant of slaves, and it just imposes them into that exact model. So, for example, the only Latino people I know who say Latinx are people who went to top tier universities.
That's right.
Who were from that Texas county, were from Miami, understood that if you want to get the job at Goldman Sachs, there's language that you use. And it's just the subsuming part of it that I think in many ways is directly contradictory and uncomfortable with your point about there being a progressive or liberal instinct to listen, to have diversity. And it's just this, it's liberal imperialism isn't the right way to put it, but there's something, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Right. It's like it. Yeah, it's this, I mean, there's definitely credentialism way more on the East Coast, right? Like, that's one thing I really didn't like about in New York. Like, everyone had gone to Harvard or some school.
I see a lot of people from Stanford in the text.
But
credentialism is different than a network. I guess there being a network effect is kind of different than a literal credential, but I'll be generous there.
Yeah, I mean, your GitHub repo is going to get you a lot more jobs on the West Coast than a piece of paper with some expensive piece of paper. Fair. But which is not going to happen on the East Coast. But yeah, I think the weird thing is if they parse the external world, it's because they were in their like Latino studies, the one seminar they took, whatever, at Yale, taught by whatever, someone who maybe has an interesting academic point of view. Maybe they're just careerists who made a career out of being like the professional Latino in the room, which, not to be too dismissive about it, it's kind of what they're being, right? To a whole elite class of Americans who, let's face it, are not diverse at all. If you actually look at like the average family income of a lot of these people, they come from a very narrow set of American families in the United States. It's not Cuban exile kids whose parents came with nothing, right? And walked through Freedom Town, the Cuban Refugee Center in Miami, or it's not people from like hard scrabble border towns in Texas, right? Like those aren't the people you're sort of rubbing shoulders with, right? Hate to break it to you, right? It's either people who've made a career for themselves, kind of parsing that for that elite world in ways that make sense inside that academic reward system, or it's people who don't come from that world at all, right? Who just, who sort of masquerade as that to some degree, but aren't really from that. And so I can see how it would be difficult if you really come from like the Northeastern Yankee, like Ivy League world, to understand the Latino mindset. Like what exposure would you have had to it? None, right? But it's just weird that, I mean, it's kind of a red state, blue state thing, because I do spend time in red states. I was raised in one kind of. It's weird to have all these elite people who are like hyper-focused on tolerance and diversity. And within those elite redoubts, there's like none, right? Like all this super focus on diversity and whatnot, like in Silicon Valley, for example, Facebook or Apple or any other places that I've worked at, right? And it's like some of these diverse places, at least in terms of educational and socioeconomic background, often ethnically it is, and there's a lot of Asians there and stuff, right? But in terms of like that elite crew, it's not like Miami, right? Where like I was raised being able to distinguish between 10 different types of Latin American Spanish, because it was Colombians and Venezuelans and Cubans and whatnot, like, and then Haitian. There was just this ethnic and cultural ferment, right? That was kind of broad and truly diverse, right? And you go to these places that are hyper-focused on it, and it's like the most white bread places I've ever been in my entire life. And so it's just, it's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Like maybe they're reacting to their own white breadness and saying, oh, well, we need to be more accepting. But then it's like, oh, let's just hire more Stanford grads. And I'm not sure you're really amping up the diversity score for Stanford grads. But maybe we've gone slightly off topic here, Marshall.
No, that's okay. This has been building for a while, and it takes a very specific guest to have this conversation. And you are the person who the dial fell on. So Antonio, thank you so much for joining. Where can everyone find you?
I spend way too much time on Twitter at Antonio GM. And then also the Substack is the pull request, P-U-L-L request.com is also another place to find me.
Add the,
yes. Otherwise you're going to go to a software development tool company, which I'm sure it's a great product, but it's not what you're looking for. No.
Thanks for coming.
Sure. Thanks, Mark.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Like I said, this went a bunch of different places, but I think it's super valuable for us to have wide-ranging conversations that help us think a little harder and look at the world through a lens that we wouldn't have thought of before. Once again, Antonio's book, Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley, can be found at our bookshop, and definitely go check out the pullrequest.substack.com to support him as he goes and makes his way as an independent writer on Substack. As always, thank you to the Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Be sure to check out the conference and the Policy Hackers Fellowship. We'll see you all next week.